Before we get into the sermon proper this morning, I want to say a couple of things about liturgical elements. We tend to value words when we're thinking about describing something or explaining something or expressing something as a way of kind of describing reality. And of course, that's, you know, fair enough. If I say tree and you have a way of, you know, you'd say, well, sort of green and sort of shaped like this or that. And, you know, we would try to use words. I guess that's why we all like that game. What's that game where you have to act things out? Charades. Yes, that's probably why we all like charades, because it makes us use another part of our brain. And that's fair enough. I mean, words are great. They are what they are. But in the Bible, when God comes to make his final, most precise, most pure expression of himself, the Word becomes flesh. And God says, I have something that's actually a better way to describe my ultimate revelation. And that's why for 2,000 years, the church has valued liturgy and sacrament. Sacrament simply being a physical way of expressing something that is more importantly a spiritual or mystical reality. And it's why the church has always done church decoration. So, for instance, this is Sunday of the Epiphany, meaning Emmanuel, and we've been reading about this for a couple weeks, God with us, you know, manifestation, him revealing himself to us, and now this morning about the baptism of Jesus. Well, those of you who are with us when we were at Rock Harbor, you may remember that sometimes we'd change the way the chairs were, and that was about all we could do in that room to sort of mark the seasons of the church and time. Well, this morning, we don't have the ability to move pews. I think Vanguard would not be happy with us to unscrew their pews and move them around. But we were able to say, hey, God has come to us, Emmanuel. He's present with us, and he has manifested himself to us. And so what we've done in this morning in the room is just to try to create some movement from the altar, being symbolic of Christ's presence with us, moving towards us and on the floor. Now, there's something very good about marking time this way. Without the church calendar, we would end up marking time the way many people do by, you know, Super Bowl or, you know, the NCAA championship game and then March Madness and then the World Series and then, I don't know, the start of the football season in fall or something. Or maybe if you're really into TV, you know, you'd mark it by, you know, the new shows are starting in a few weeks. Now we got those dadgum reruns and then, you know. But, you know, everybody marks time somehow. And what the church calendar does is it invites us into marking time in a different sort of way. I didn't have any grandparents that I knew. They all died very young. But I had a great grandmother. And so she was sort of everybody's grandmother because she was the only one around. She was born in 1883 and lived to be 106, and very healthy into her 90s, into the mid-90s, late 90s, very sort of normal, healthy person, you know, would do ironing and wash and all that. Well, just think about that for a moment, how much fun it was for us as kids to listen to her tell stories. Just think about this, her tell stories of her mom and dad being afraid that Jesse James might come to town. Did you catch that? She lived before there were cars. I mean, cars, you know, sort of production automobiles didn't come till the early 1900s, somewhere between, if you want to count Oldsmobile in 1902 or Ford in 1914, whatever it was. She was a teenager. She saw cars, you know, be sort of come, you know, to become something in life. Dallas Willard, who's only 75, loves to tell the story of growing up as a little boy in Missouri without electricity and how much it changed their life, he says, when the kingdom of electricity came to southern Missouri. Radically changed everything, all their notions of night and day, because now they could make day last as long as they want through lights. And they didn't have to go out and beat rugs anymore. They could get a Hoover, and they could Hoover those rugs. I mean, it changed everything. I saw an article this week that for children who are born this year, in this first year of this new decade, they will never know videotape, travel agents, books, newspapers and magazines, video rental stores. Watches. Well, maybe it's a quaint piece of jewelry, but who needs a watch anymore? When everyone soon will have one of these. Paper maps, wired phones, long-distance calls, newspaper classifieds, dial-up internet, encyclopedias. Remember when those guys used to come to your door to try to sell you these big things of encyclopedias that now fit, you know, you'd have to go buy a bookcase for? Well, all of us in this room who are students and teachers who in any way work in academia, we just now know anything that's on the Encyclopedia Britannica, I can get right here. Do you want to know why I knew that Ohl's started production cars in 1902? Because before the service started this morning, I sat down and Googled it right here. They'll never know encyclopedias. They'll never have forgotten friends, not with Facebook. Why would anybody forget a friend? They'll never have a forgotten anything because the daily knowledge of human life is now right here. They'll never know the evening news, CDs, film cameras, yellow or white pages, fax machines, wires at all, handwritten letters, mail. Think about it. I'm telling you, in our lifetime, mail as we know it is probably going away, other than we'll have a hard time shutting down a major federal bureaucracy. But beyond that, if you take out the trash, and if you take out what you can now do online, paying bills and stuff, what's left? Everybody just Facebooks each other. Now, when was the last time a friend of yours wrote you a handwritten letter? Now, some of you are probably, you know, I don't know, you might have a friend like that. And God bless you if you do, because that'd be really wonderful. But for most people now, it's a text. Or it's an inbox in your Facebook or something like that. Commercials on TV, commercial music radio. Hiding. This one's really important to me. I actually hate this. When I was the president of Alpha, the president of the board, who was very wealthy, and used to say to me, Todd, come on, I'll get you a BlackBerry. And I would always go, no, Dave, I don't want a BlackBerry, I want a life. Because I knew as soon as I got a BlackBerry or any kind of smartphone that I could no longer hide. Kids born in 2011 will never again be able to hide. Because it's not going to be long that this just doesn't allow me to find you, but it allows everybody else through GPS technology to find us. It used to be when your landline, they'll probably know that phrase. They'll never know that phrase, landline. It used to be when your landline rung, nobody knew if you were in the garage or in the bathroom or out mowing the lawn. You could just be wherever you were. You could hide. Well, they'll never know a time like that. So human time marches on, and in the main, the things that interest us are either those sort of inventive things or predicting the future, what things will be like. But I want to help us stop and think this morning about time in a different way. Time is not a commodity. You can't save it. It's not like mints in your pocket. I remember when Debbie and I were really young, we started our first church in Wheeling. One of our very, very closest friends was a lady named Teresa, but we all called her Tink. I don't know where she got that. But Tink loved candy, and I loved candy. And we were very close friends, and so I always knew when Tink came over that I could go into her jacket pocket and find a piece of candy. Or in her car, you know, the little side things in your door where you can keep things? She always had candy there. Well, time's not like that. You can't save it. It's not like mints or gum in your jack pocket. You can't manipulate it or control it. Time just simply passes by second, hour by hour, day by day, and it does that the same way for all 6 billion people on the planet. The only thing we can do with time is experience it. You can't create 5 more minutes when you have a paper due, or it's midnight on April 15th and your taxes are due. You can't create 5 more minutes. You can't find 5 more minutes that you'd saved early in the day. No, they just flowed by. And you can't make time go by faster when you're in pain or waiting for a plane or Christmas morning. You can only experience the 24 hours that flow by every day. And if you want to experience it differently, you have to restructure the way you experience it. I.e., if you want to encounter God, you have to restructure your life in a way that allows it to happen. But you're never going to have more time. It just goes by. So I want to stop and think about this morning with reference to the story that these readings tell us about what God is up to on the earth today, about how it is that he marks time. And he marks time according to divine intention. And we have these sort of big mountain peaks in the story. And what we read today in Isaiah 42 is one of those big mountain peaks that says, take a look at my servant. I'm expressing what I'm up to in time through him. He's my chosen one, the one in whom I delight. We have another big mountain peak in the readings this morning where Jesus is publicly baptized and God says of him, this is my son whom I love and I'm going to put my spirit on him and I'm going to uphold him. Well, these big mountain peaks don't come out of the blue. They arise precisely within both a divine and a human story. And the backdrop of the human story is this, that all over the world right now, this moment, people live in circumstances of exploitation and oppression. And they long for intervention. They long to be free. Now, I've never told you this, but I suppose now's the time. I sometimes struggle with claustrophobia when I'm flying, and I fly all the time. I have for many years flown well over 100,000 miles. I've probably flown 2 or 3 million miles in my life. But occasionally, if I'm just, I don't know, anxious or nervous or uptight or something, or, you know, I'd been busy, and then got on this plane, and especially one of those little regional jets, God, I hate those things. I'm okay if it's moving. Like, I have no fear of flying, nothing like that. I actually love flying, except for sometimes it makes me feel really claustrophobic. So imagine if I was one of those people stuck on the tarmac for 11 hours in one of those little planes. I don't know if you've ever read about it, but people start pacing and moaning. The flight crew literally loses control of the cabin. There's sometimes toilets overflowing, babies screaming, no more water. Can you imagine? Or imagine me being stuck in an elevator. That's my second least favorite thing. Like when I go somewhere, I tell people I don't want to stay in a high-rise hotel. I mean, if I have to, I do, but I would prefer not to. So imagine somebody like me being stuck in an elevator with 30 people or something in a high-rise hotel that gets stuck. Most of humanity lives like that every day. Stuck with no hope. There's never going to be more food. There's never in their lifetime going to be clean water. There's never going to be a time where they could marry somebody they wanted to marry. They're going to be forced to marry somebody whose dad gave them away to in some sort of political deal. And there's no light at the end of their tunnel. And our story this morning has these two huge, big mountain peaks that where God says, not if I have anything to say about it. This is my servant whom I love. This is my son whom I say publicly here at his baptism that I'm doing something through him, that there's a divine affect here, not just a divine intention and a divine initiation, but a divine affect that says, Isaiah says, that Israel, and then Jesus, the sort of ideal Israel, is going to enact God's transformative healing on the whole world. That they exist for the whole world. And that he's going to set everything right among the nations, steadily, firmly setting things right. And that he's not going to be stopped until he's finished his work to set things right on the earth. Well, you say, well, geez, fantastic, powerful stuff, Todd, but what does this have to do with us? What this has to do with us is that that's the covenant we're in. That's why we have this new covenant. The covenant that God made with Israel has been sort of redone. And the passage in Acts tells us that it's now called everybody up into it. Even those who are bruised reeds and, flickering, you know, about to go out candles, they count. They're in on it. Everybody gets to be in on this. I am God, he says. I've called you to live right and well. And I've taken responsibility for you, and I'm going to keep you safe through this. That you can be a lighthouse to the nations. That you can make a start at bringing people into the open, out of their oppression, into the light, opening blind eyes, releasing prisoners from dungeons, emptying dark prisons. And God says, if you look at your passage in Isaiah, he says, and here's how you can know this is true. The former things I told you, that you were going to go into judgment if you disobeyed me, that's happened, hasn't it? You've been in bondage, haven't you? And they would all go, yeah, we get it. And now God says, see, I'm doing a new thing. There's probably no passage in all of my 35 years of being a Christian that has been more abused than that passage. See, I'm doing a new thing. If a Christian school, not to pick on Vanguard, but if a Christian school wants to put in a raise money for a new sidewalk from this building to that building, they're often use this text. See, behold, I tell you, I'm doing a new thing, and why don't you help us? Or, you know, if a church wants to start a tithing campaign, see, I'm doing a new thing. But this actually has historical meaning. God is saying you're no longer going to be in bondage, but you're going to come and be my light. And the focus of our readings this morning is this, is that we're invited into Israel's story. For every person in this room, for everybody you know who has any kind of Jewish background, it always stuns them when I say to them, you know what, I'm in your story. I'm not inviting you into my story. This is your story. This was going on long before I came along or the Gentiles were let in. This is your story. The Gentiles were led into your story. Now, I don't mean to say by that the Jews who are alive today don't need to receive Christ. Of course, they do. But historically, it's true that what we're doing is in continuity with their story and what God was doing through Israel. The message of the Acts passage, if you want to look at it, is that now it's just saying God plays no favorites. It doesn't matter if you're Jew or Greek or male or female or old or young or rich or poor. Everybody can get in on this story. If you want to be a part of what God's doing and how he marks time. And the psalmist simply tells us that God's really serious about this. That the voice of the Lord thunders. And he says, I am the Lord, that's my name. I will not yield my glory to another or my praise to idols. And so when the psalmist asks us to ascribe to the Lord these features of God and the way he expresses his divine intention, when he asks us to ascribe to the Lord, that means use your brain. To ascribe has to do with attributing. Because you recognize something, you attribute something to somebody. That's mostly mental work. But when the psalmist says, and then worship him, that has to do with your will. That has to do with the human space in which God has given you capacity to make choices. Sometimes called volition, the capacity to act. And so the psalmist is saying, bring your life through mental and emotional and social and your physical body, bring all this into alignment with what God's doing. That is the invitation of the story this morning. And so we just see Peter trying to enact that, saying, wow, this is a huge story. God started doing this thing through Israel, and then, you know, Jesus was baptized in the Jordan, and we saw that him live this incredible life, but you all killed him. But we saw him raised from the dead, and he appeared to us, and he's asked us to be in on his story, announcing what God's up to, which, of course, includes life, death, burial, resurrection, and ascension. And that includes us going to heaven when we die, but it can't be reduced to it. It also means that God has this thing that he's trying to do on earth, not just in heaven. In fact, if you're fair to the text, and I know this can be a bit unsettling, but just think about it. Go home and test all these things and see if you think I'm right. But when you get right down to it, the basic message of our text is that heaven comes here. And that God renews this time-space continuum. And heaven is simply the sphere, the space and place in which God is God. And yes, someday we will all live unceasingly in heaven. But that's not some wooey-wooey out there having nothing to do with earth kind of thing. It has precisely to do with earth. And this is a bit startling to us. Things don't always appear when you're dealing with Jesus the way you think they'll appear. This is what happened in our gospel reading this morning. Look at it in your order of service. Things aren't playing out the way John expected. It's kind of like shocked at meeting someone for the first time and they don't look or act like you thought they would. Right? Anybody ever used a dating service? And even if you've seen pictures and everything, you know, you get to the first date and you just go, oh my gosh, there's something about this man or woman's being that is just nothing like what I thought it would be. It's kind of a deep disappointment. Like, I had never been to the Forum in Inglewood, I don't know, maybe for concerts in high school or something, but I'd never seen a Laker game there. And finally, just, I don't know, right before the Forum closed and the Staples Center's open, I've never been to the Staples Center. But before the Forum closed, somebody at one of my former churches was a corporate person and had tickets to the Laker game, really good Laker tickets. And this is when Magic Johnson had sort of come back out of retirement and was playing again. And we get there that night and he's injured and not playing. That's the kind of thing that's happening to John the Baptist here. And I think what this story does of John is it invites us to learn to be surprised by Jesus again. What good is an epiphany, a movement of God towards you, if it doesn't somehow surprise us? When God says of Israel, "This is my servant," when he says of Jesus, "This is my son," what this teaches us and what John was learning is that Jesus doesn't come to fulfill our plans. He comes to fulfill God's. "This is my son, chosen and marked by my love, divine delight of my life." Well, if this is what God's doing, and human life is sort of passing, being marked by inventions and, you know, the Super Bowl and March Madness and, you know, the beginning of baseball season and all that, if that's what's happening, I want you to think this morning, just picture yourself sitting in front of your laptop or your desktop, and let's say you got a couple of programs running. Let's say you got Word up and you got your email client up. And they're both there running simultaneously. Now then, just picture God's thing running and his divine initiation, his divine intention. He's focused. He's not going to relent. His voice is going to win. God does not have ADD. This is sort of an unstoppable thing. This is going to happen. And then our thing is running. And we mark it the way we mark it. Time is passing. But what these stories tell us this morning is that if we want in on God's thing, this thing that he's doing, we do not need more time. And you're never going to get it. What we need is a reordering of our desires. You're never going to get more time. You're not going to find an extra hour on Wednesday in your pocket. What we need is a reordering of our desires and a restructuring of the time that we do have. The 24/7 that we all have, the sort of challenge or goal then is to match our desires to the thing that God's got going on. Last thought. When Israel went public through the baptism of passage through the Red Sea, as sort of an analogy of baptism, they were given the law as a sign, a covenant, and a guiding presence in the form of a pillar of fire and a cloud. When Jesus came up out of the water, he was given the Spirit, we might say, and he heard this approving voice of God. The invitation of our readings this morning is this. If you want in on this story, if you want to be a servant of divine intention, then set aside your plans and submit to his and accept the surprises as they come. Because there is no manifestation without surprise. And then second, listen. For if you listen, you will hear the exact same voice. I don't know. Who do you love, ladies? George Clooney? I mean, what if you could sit with him and actually hear his voice? I don't know. Who do you love, guys? Who's the new heartthrob? What if you could actually hear her silky voice? Well, it's not just preacher talk to say that if you take your life It's not just sermon jargon to say that if you take your life and you make that decision to reorder your desires and restructure the time you do have to place yourself in that story, that is the voice that you will hear and none other. I stake my whole reputation and life on that. You make yourself alert to God, present to what he's doing, aligning yourself with him, and the same exact voice that Jesus heard that day in the Jordan in the wilderness is the voice that you will hear directing, helping, shaping, leading, in gifting, shaping your character, clarifying your mind, allowing you to ascribe to life what's real, touching you deep in your volition and sense of capacity to make choices. That voice will meet you. If not that voice, what are the voice? The voice of some sort of human superstition? The voice of a church? You're not going to hear the voice of a pope. You're not going to hear my voice. If you hear a voice, it will be the exact same voice that John and Jesus and the onlookers heard. That is the promise of this story. And thirdly, do it in faith, and you will receive the exact same Spirit. The Spirit that alighted on Jesus like a dove will be the Spirit that will alight on your life and light you a path that directs you into this big divine story. Amen.